Natasha Trethewey's poems tell the stories of forgotten people. We revisit our conversation with the former poet laureate about how poetry can help Americans better understand each other.
You know, some of the things that I say may sound incendiary to someone, but it's very different if you hear it in a poem. Because that is, you know, the intimate nature of the soul trying to communicate with someone else's soul.
But first, 1 in 5 children in Illinois are from families who worry about where they'll get their next meal from.
Hunger, of course, is an issue 365 days a year, but in the summer, you know, we find it's one of the hungriest times of year for kids.
We talked to the Illinois State Board of Education and 2 food banks in Chicago and Central Illinois to find out what's being done to get healthy meals to kids in Illinois this summer. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. The latest news is next. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. In Illinois, 20% of children don't know where their next meal will come from. And in the summer, when school's out, that problem is much worse. While schools give free or reduced lunches to many students, something we were talking about on the program last week, only 14% of kids who qualify are able to access summer meal programs. The challenge gets even bigger when we're talking about rural areas throughout the state. We're going to talk about what's driving the program and what's being done to get healthy meals to children in the summer. Joining us in our Urbana studio is Jim Hires. He's president and CEO of Eastern Illinois Food Bank in Urbana. Also on the line with us is Alicia Hugley. She's the Senior Director of Public Policy at the Greater Chicago Food Depository. Jim, Alicia, welcome to the 21st. Thank you so much for being with me.
Well, thank you.
Jim, I wonder
thank
if you can just...
Me.
Yeah, thanks so much for being with us, Alicia. Jim, for Eastern Illinois Food Bank, what does the situation look like in the summertime? Do you see more of a need for food and donations?
Well, we see not so much food donations, particularly around the program that we're talking about with the summer meal program for children. Our challenge in the summer is finding spots for students who are out of school and children to be access programs in the summer. You mentioned in a rural area, it's just far more difficult. So we have to really work at knowing where programs are, keeping abreast in each of our 17 counties where families can access summer meals.
And does that then, Jim, include summer camps? Are we talking about YMCA? Are there other options besides summer camps where you make backpacks and other programs available for children?
Some of our schools that are in the backpack program carry that program off over through the summer, but and some elect not to. We've tried to open school pantries in various areas that students and their families can access food. But primarily, we try to encourage schools, particularly in our more populous areas. We do have meal sites in those communities, but it's the problem begins when you have a school that may cover an entire county. And that becomes very, very difficult for us to manage.
Right. And I imagine it becomes difficult also for children to get to that school in the summer. Alicia, what does it look like in Chicago?
Yeah. So, you know, I would say some similar, some different challenges. You know, hunger, of course, is an issue 365 days a year. But in the summer, you know, we find it's one of the hungriest times of year for kids, again, because those, you know, free and reduced meals that kids can have access to during the school year, those are no longer available during the summer. And so, you know, I think a lot of the meal sites are similar to what Jim described, but, you know, really, I mean, it can be any community organization. So some schools continue to offer meals through the summer if they're open for summer school, different community organizations. We also have, you know, partnerships with libraries and others. So I think we try to be as creative as possible to get out to as many kids as we can during the summer months.
We've been speaking with Jim Hires, President and CEO of the Eastern Illinois Food Bank, Alicia Hugley. She's a Senior Director of Public Policy at the Greater Chicago Food Depository. I want to bring someone else into this conversation. Amy Bianco directs the Summer Meals Program with the Illinois State Board of Education. Amy, thanks for joining us as well this morning.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the Summer Food Service Program? We've been hearing Jim and Alicia sort of talk about what it looks like on the ground across Central Illinois and the Chicago area in terms of schools and access. What does ISBE do with the Summer Food Service Program?
ISBE is the one who administers the program. So we start early in the year bringing awareness to the program and trying to get sponsors throughout the state to come in, just like the Greater Chicago Food Depository and the Food Bank. And then we do the training for the sponsors as they come in. And then we also do the approving of the sponsors. And then we have also a compliance staff that goes on later in the summer. But so we coordinate and administer the program. And right now we have probably over 2,000 sites throughout the state and over 1,000 sites in the city of Chicago alone.
Amy, I know we saw an increase in children utilizing the summer food programs last year. Are we expecting an increase again this year?
Yes, definitely. We've been working with a lot of partners, and we also did some information sessions throughout the state. We looked to see what counties, you know, may or may not have very many sites, and so we try to hit those areas especially so that we can bring that access of the food to the kids in those counties.
And who can sponsor these sites?
Sponsors can be schools. They can be any unit of the local government, cities, food banks, housing authorities, park districts. And then we have churches that can belong as sponsors, and then also any other non-for-profit organization that has their 501c3 status.
Alicia, when we look at this problem, as you think about your role in public policy, I also know you work with No Kid Hungry. I wonder if you can give us a sense. I think people have a lot of stereotypes about the notion of food insecurity and who's eligible for these programs. What can you tell us in particular about children who are accessing these programs?
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, as you mentioned, we are the No Kid Hungry Illinois partner. And, you know, I mean, we know that 1 in 5 children are at risk of hunger, and that oftentimes those children are in households where people are working. They're in urban areas, they're in suburban areas, they're in rural areas. And so it's, you know, it's really an issue that, you know, I think touches all of our communities. And so one of the things that we really work on a lot, particularly around summer meals, is raising awareness. So raising awareness about both the issue of child hunger and the, you know, importance of working to solve the issue, but then raising awareness about the availability of summer meals and of the programs. And, you know, ISBE and others do a terrific job of getting information out there about it. But we really want folks to know that, you know, there are, as Amy said, 2,000 sites around the state, and there's lots of different ways that people can find out about sites near them.
What's the best way in the Chicago area for people to find out about sites, Alicia?
So fortunately, we actually have, it's sort of a statewide. So no matter where you are in Illinois, I think one of the best ways is just to send a text message. That seems to be a very popular approach these days. And so people can text FOODIL, so it's FOODIL, to 877-877. And once you do that, it will just prompt you to enter your zip code, and then you get great information about sites near you. If text message doesn't work for folks, they can visit summermealsillinois.org. And there's a cool interactive map there. And then, of course, there is a hunger hotline, and that is 1-800-359-2163. So people have lots of options. And, you know, all of the sort of lists that both the text message and the website and everything are pulling from, those are updated on a weekly basis in case there are any changes to schedules. And so lots of good options for people to figure out what sites are near them.
If you didn't have a chance to write those down, those numbers, don't worry. We will tweet all of that out. We'll have a graphic that's going out that has all of those numbers. We'll also have that up at our website at 21stshow.org. So if you can remember 21stshow.org, you can see all of that information afterwards. Jim, how do you try to spread the word in Central Illinois about the availability of services, apart from, as Alicia mentioned, all of the great technological ways that people can access this information?
Well, we provide food to 200 agencies across our 17 counties, and our partnership coordinators work with those agency volunteers and managers to make sure when clients come in, they know and about the summer meal program within their communities. And also in our area, we use a service called 211, where you can call and that information is available. Our agencies are our best partners in that, because a lot of the people who visit summer meal programs also visit their local food pantry.
Mm-hmm. And when we think about that, Amy, I wonder, when we think about the fact that these are programs that are normally handled for school, am I correct in understanding that most of that, though, that money then does come from the federal government? I know last year there were some issues with state funding around this as well, correct?
Correct. The dollars for the summer food program are federal dollars. However, at state level, the state has to give us the authority, grant the authority for us to receive the federal dollars. But, yes, it is all
federal.
Has
that happened
dollars.
This year? Has that happened this year?
Not yet, I don't believe. I have not heard that they have done that yet.
So is there any concern about funding programs for this year?
No. Like I said, being federal dollars, they will come through. It may take, you know, there may be a 1 or 2 week lag in getting the authority to spend it. But, yeah, it shouldn't be a problem.
And can I ask, is it up to parents to enroll children to make sure that they qualify for free and reduced lunches? Or do schools play a role with ISBE? Do you work with schools to learn about children who may need help?
There's two different types of sites that the program has. There's open sites and closed sites. Closed sites is where the sponsor is just going to feed the children that are enrolled in their program specifically. But the open sites, which is what will be on the website and the hotline and the texting feature, those sites are open to anyone 18 and under, so there's no registration of children or anything like that. They can come from anywhere, 18 and under, and go to an open site and receive a free meal.
And Alicia, is that information as to whether a site is open or not, I imagine, also on the websites, and that's pretty clear when you look at a site, what kind of site it is?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great point. So as long as the technology is all working right, we only promote the open sites because, again, for the closed sites, you have to be already enrolled in that program. And so when folks are texting, they're getting information about those open sites that anybody can walk into at any time.
And so is it the idea then the open sites are sort of the alternative methods to getting children and young people into these programs for food? Are there other ways that families that need help can find out about it?
So I think, I mean, for the open sites, so the open sites can be both a, you know, a combination of, they can offer programming. So sometimes those open sites are offering summer programming, but then kids, in addition to those kids who are participating in the programming, can come in and also get a meal. And so in that way, it's open. But there are other types of programs. So, for example, the Food Depository does something during the summer called the Lunch Bus. And so what it does is it has four different routes that kind of go throughout Chicago and the south suburban part of Cook County, makes 24 different stops each weekday, and distributes free meals to kids that way at parks and churches, libraries, and other places to be able to reach kids in different ways there. So, again, hopefully, you know, if folks, and part of that is so that if there isn't one that's sort of geographically convenient for folks to reach, that is another option that would be available to them as well.
Jim, do you feel like you have enough coverage in the central Illinois area? I know you mentioned working with libraries and other places. You mentioned challenges in areas where there's maybe one school district. Are there gaps across more rural areas, even outside of central Illinois, other parts of the state?
Oh, my, yes. In fact, if you get into deep southern Illinois, the gaps are enormous, just the distances. And the program with the Lunch Bus is a very intriguing program. And about 3 years ago, members of the Feeding Illinois, the Food Bank Association, tried to put together a program where we were going to pilot just the same kind of program in very, very rural areas and have a central preparation place. The distances traveled would be pretty, pretty far. We're talking sometimes an hour to an hour and a half drive for the vehicle. But we could not get that pulled off for that pilot year. And I think as time goes, we're going to have to find that kind of solution. For example, if you use a vendor that prepares the meal program for the school programs, then we find funds to purchase those meals, and then we deliver those to those same kind of areas, much the way Chicago does with the Lunch Bus. But again, it's geography.
Alicia, I wonder if you can, we're almost out of time here, but I wonder as we think about wrapping up this conversation, what you want folks to know about the situation in the summer with school children across the state of Illinois.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I want folks to know sort of, you know, what they can do, and because I think ultimately as a community, we all have a different role that we can play into helping solve this issue. And so, you know, summer meal sites need volunteers. And so think about reaching out to your local food bank. You can also go to summermealsillinois.org and contact us there. We can connect you. And again, help us get the word out. So it sounds like you guys are going to put on Twitter and other places all that contact information I shared, you know, so let people know about that. And, you know, if you're in a place where you can hang posters and other things for us, that's great. And the last thing I would say, you know, if you work for an organization or an entity that would be in a position to either actually be a summer meals site or possibly even a sponsor, to really consider that. ISBE is incredibly supportive in helping make that possible for folks. So I would ask everybody to think about what role you can play in ending child hunger, particularly during the summer.
And to be a sponsor site, again, you said libraries, churches, other places like that?
Yeah, it's pretty open, and there's lots of ways you can come at it. So
I want to thank, that's Alicia Hugelay. She's a Senior Director of Public Policy at the Greater Chicago Food Depository, No Hungry Kid Partner as well. Amy Bianco on the line with us with the Illinois State Board of Education, where she's the director of the Summer Meals Program. And, of course, in studio in Urbana, Jim Hires. He's the president and CEO of the Eastern Illinois Food Bank. Jim, Alicia, Amy, thanks for letting us know about this very important issue.
Can I, one last thought?
Sure, go ahead.
We've got Chicago Kickoff is going to be happening on Friday, June 23rd, and it will be at Horner Park from 10 to 2. There'll be a lot of activities going on. We have the Jesse White tumblers. Meals will be served to children, and it should be a great day.
All right, great. So for folks in the Chicago area, that's a great message for them. Thanks again, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
The 21st is made possible by the Library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, preparing students and scholars for their fields by offering access to today's cutting-edge equipment and technology within advanced library environments and facilities. The University Library at Illinois.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. This is a special rebroadcast of a previous episode. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Natasha Trethewey is a Pulitzer Prize-winning poet. She's also the former Poet Laureate of the United States and a Southerner. She was born to a white father and a black mother in Mississippi. Interracial marriage was still illegal when her parents got married. She started writing poetry in college from 2012 to 2014. She served as the Poet Laureate of the United States. She's also the author of four collections of poetry and a creative nonfiction book about Hurricane Katrina. Her writing explores memory, race, and the lives of people forgotten by history. She's currently a professor of English and creative writing at Emory University. Natasha, welcome to the 21st. Thank you so much for being here with me.
Thank you, Nyla.
When did you first start writing poetry?
Well, I wrote poetry like a lot of people as a kid. I think I wrote my first poems when I was in the third grade, and I had a third grade teacher and librarian who bound that collection of poems and put them in our library, and I felt very much like a poet. But I began writing poems seriously again in graduate school. I thought I was going to be a fiction writer when I went to graduate school, but I quickly learned that I was indeed a poet.
And so much of your poetry focuses on being interracial, and I wanted to ask you about your parents' marriage. So your parents got married, and it was actually illegal. They couldn't get married in Mississippi because they were an interracial couple.
That's right. I tend to write a lot about history, and certainly in writing about history and the history of the United States, race is there because race is woven into the very fabric of our country, and I write about it to the extent that it is American. But I do also investigate my own personal history, and some of that history is about my parents' interracial marriage being biracial. They met at Kentucky State College, which is one of the HBCUs, the historically black colleges and universities. My mother went there as a black woman from Mississippi. My father, who came down from Canada, went there because when he got out a guide to American colleges and universities, he discovered that it was one that he could afford without realizing that it was a black college. And he ended up there and met my mother. They first tried to get married in Frankfort, Kentucky, and were turned away. And they had to cross.
What year was this?
That was 1965.
Wow.
So they
not
crossed the river.
Not long ago at all.
No, not when you think about it. When you think that we are now in 2017 about to celebrate the Loving versus the State of Virginia decision that finally ruled that those anti-miscegenation laws were unconstitutional.
So they had to cross the river, you were saying?
They crossed the Ohio River into Cincinnati and got married there.
And so when you were a child, were you aware of all of this? Was this something that was – I imagine it's not something that parents would probably discuss with their kids.
I had the kind of parents that would discuss it.
Okay.
And it's hard to live in Mississippi and not know what's going on because people glared at us, yelled things at us, burned a cross in the yard. Mm. It was easy to know at a very young age.
And how did they explain everything to you? How did they talk about it?
You know, I think that they said the kinds of things that I imagine a lot of parents in interracial marriages tell their children, that you have the best of both worlds. It's a very, you know, happy message of, you know, cultural blending. And but they also were very open and honest about talking about racism in America and the kinds of things that we would face because we were a blended family.
How much of that you think is an important part of your poetry now? You mentioned something about American history. Mm-hmm. I think there's so much of Black history that I think is not taught as part of American history. I think we're learning so much more. As someone who grew up in the South, mm-hmm. I feel like there's a lot I didn't learn. Mm-hmm. As someone who had a Southern, and you know, growing up in Florida, there was a lot I did not learn about Florida and Florida's racist history until mm-hmm. I was an adult, actually living in the Midwest, and reading things like Isabel Wilkerson's, you know, The Great Might, reading things about, learning a lot about what it was like. Mm-hmm. I wonder how much of, and I think so much of your work is about sort of providing that voice, providing a lens to people who are forgotten. How do you go about doing that?
Well, in my third collection, Native Guard, one of the things that I wrote about was the history of black participation in the Civil War. The historian Eric Foner points out that of the hundreds of Civil War monuments, North and South, only a handful mention anything about black soldiers, even as nearly 200,000 of them fought in the Civil War. Now, I am from the Mississippi Gulf Coast, a little town called Gulfport, and just off the coast of Gulfport is a fort called Fort Massachusetts, which is where the Louisiana Native Guards were stationed. The Louisiana Native Guards were among the first regiments of African-American Union soldiers mustered into service in the Civil War. And if you take the tour of the fort, as I did on the 4th of July, every year, there's no mention of the black soldiers there. It was one of these histories that was sort of erased or forgotten or buried. And so I started trying to uncover and tell the story of those black soldiers, which, of course, is an American story. It is deeply American. And now things have changed out on Ship Island. There's a plaque on the mainland before you go out there recognizing this history that belongs to all Americans.
So you said things have changed. How do you think – what role do you think poetry can play and help uncover this, right? Because it's interesting that you're in this realm as a poet. I think a lot of people would think, oh, this is what historians should do, mm-hmm. or this is what – and I think poetry is a form of education, but mm-hmm. I think people would think this is something teachers should be doing or historians should be
doing. Well, of course, professional historians are the ones who've been working on these issues forever. I mean, I turn to the work of professional historians in order to animate the characters I invent for poems. And yet, perhaps too few people read the interesting work of professional historians like I do.
Right.
But there is a way that poetry can reach a different kind of audience, just as all art can reach different kinds of audiences. And so the people who were working to get a monument erected, some kind of historical marker erected on the Gulf Coast, were thrilled and welcoming me to the struggle, in a sense, because of the attention that the book got as a book of poems. All of a sudden, more people know about it than might have known about it. And so we have to kind of pool the resources of historians and playwrights and poets and teachers to tell those stories.
I'm speaking with Natasha Trethewey. We're talking about her poetry. She's a Pulitzer Prize-winning poet, former poet laureate of the United States. And as you're talking about those characters, I wonder how, when you're sort of doing research, do you just put yourself in that world? How do you come up with these characters? Is it something where you're sort of imagining all of their lives and then you're writing poetry about them? Mm-hmm. What's that process like for you?
Well, I spend a good bit of time in the archives trying to read the letters that people who were stationed on the island would have kept, or reading diaries, reading newspaper accounts, traveling to the places to interact with the weather, with the climate, to imagine what their lives might have been like in a particular place. But I rely heavily on documentary evidence.
So I would love it. Would you mind reading something from this? Is your third book, Native Guard?
Mm-hmm. This is a poem about taking one of those journeys on the boat out to Ship Island. It has an epigraph from Alan Tate that reads, "Now that the salt of their blood stiffens the saltier oblivion of the sea." Elegy for the Native Guards. We leave Gulfport at noon, gulls overhead trailing the boat, streamers, noisy fanfare, all the way to Ship Island. What we see first is the fort, its roof of grass a lee, half reminder of the men who served there, a weathered monument to some of the dead. Inside we follow the ranger, hurried though we are to get to the beach. He tells of graves lost in the gulf, the island split in half when Hurricane Camille hit, shows us casemates, cannons, the store that sells souvenirs, tokens of history long buried. The Daughters of the Confederacy has placed a plaque here at the fort's entrance, each Confederate soldier's name raised hard in bronze. No names carved for the Native Guards, 2nd Regiment, Union men, Black Phalanx. What is monument to their legacy? All the grave markers, all the crude headstones, water lost. Now fish dart among their bones, and we listen for what the waves intone. Only the fort remains, near 40 feet high, round, unfinished, half open to the sky, the elements, wind, rain, God's deliberate eye.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I feel like it's hard to follow that up with a question, but I did want to ask, how do you decide? Like, how do you decide which historical lives, or how do you decide which moments how to capture in a poem?
You know, the poet Mark Doty says, our metaphors go on ahead of us. So when I started writing about the Native Guards, I knew that I was just interested in this history that I hadn't known about, that hadn't been properly memorialized or inscribed on the landscape and the landscape of our cultural imagination. And at the same time, I was coming to the point in which I'd lived as many years with my mother as without her. She was killed when I was 19. And I began writing elegies for her, to try to remember her or even to bring her back in the way that the language of a poem can, if only for a brief moment. What I didn't know is what my mother had in common with those Black soldiers, and I found it out only because I was working on a poem called Graveyard Blues. I'd been jogging in the graveyard one morning near my house, and there's a Confederate part of the cemetery, and I couldn't get past each of the headstones without stopping to read their names. It was as if they were demanding to be remembered. So I went home and I thought, well, I'm going to write a poem about these Confederate soldiers. But what came out was a poem about the day we buried my mother. And the last two lines of the poem read, "I wander now among names of the dead, my mother's name, stone pillow for my head." And the idea in those two lines, those last lines, is that if you were missing someone and grieving, you could go to the cemetery and lay your head on their stone and feel a kind of cold comfort in the hardness of the stone. And I knew that it was emotionally true when I wrote it, but it wasn't factually true. All those years, nearly 25 years later, I'd never put a stone on my mother's grave. She lay in the ground unmarked and unremembered, like those soldiers. And I realized that it had been my duty to remember her, just as it is our duty as Americans to remember and to memorialize and to erect monuments to these black soldiers who represent our history.
Do you feel like writing poetry, particularly as you're thinking about grieving the loss of your mother, do you feel like that's a – it sounds like that's another kind of comfort. You know, there's the cold comfort of the stone, but I imagine there's a lot more warmth in the metaphor or the writing the memory.
Yeah, the poem – a poem is a sacred and living language. And so in poems, she lives again in ways that she doesn't in the actual world.
And so for you, do you feel like that continues to help with – I mean, because I'm – losing a parent, losing a mother is something that is – it's not something that you can get over, right? So I wonder if this is a way that this helps you continue to grieve the loss?
I think so. I think that's sort of where I was going, and I don't know that I finally got there with that idea of our metaphors going on ahead of us. You know, I tend to look outward in order to avoid a kind of navel gazing that, of course, any of us would want to do. But is there a way to do it while also looking out at the world? And so I still feel like my historical topics choose me. But what happens is they always reveal to me the deeper metaphor, the deeper thing. And so even when I'm writing about various historical characters and historical subjects, something always in there is about that loss that I live with constantly.
It's also, in a way, though, as we're talking about loss, it's about a loss we all have as Americans and not hearing these stories. And I wonder how you sort of see that loss play out. What's sort of the result of that collective memory loss in our country today?
That collective amnesia, that memory loss, is very dangerous because often you find a complete lack of awareness. You were talking about it earlier on, the things that we're not taught in school. And our own inner lives are starved because of that. And it threatens to damage our interactions between each other. When you see incidents of what my colleague Carol Anderson would call white rage, it often is predicated on a lot of history that has been buried that people don't know about. I feel like if people knew certain things about history, they wouldn't make the kinds of racist assumptions that they make. For example, one might be, well, you know, my people came here as immigrants. Why can't these people, meaning black people, for example, get themselves together? Why can't they do what my white ancestors did? And often, if they actually knew the history and how different the history was for some groups of people versus other groups of people, they might not think that. And we might instead know how much more we are alike as Americans without focusing all the time on how different we seem to be.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Natasha Trethewey, the poet. We're talking about poetry, about American history, about America today, and we're going to talk about that when we come back.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. This is a special rebroadcast of a previous episode. I'm Nyla Boodoo, and you're listening to The 21st, and my guest is Natasha Trethewey, a former poet laureate of the United States. We're speaking with her about her poetry, her work. Your father, Eric Trethewey, was also a poet. He passed away in 2014, I believe. Before his death, you had already written, we've been talking about elegies, you had already written one for him. Mm-hmm. Why did you do that?
Well, it's a very different kind of elegy. It's, you know, generally, of course, the elegy is to remember someone who's passed. But this is a poem that elegizes something else that's lost. And so it was a very difficult poem to write, but it was a poem that I had to write in order to communicate something deeply painful with my beloved father in the only language he would really listen to, and that's the language of poetry.
And what was his response when he read it?
He loved the poem, but I think he also was a bit in denial about what I was elegizing to. And instead, he said how lucky he was to get to see a beautiful elegy before he was gone. And so that means he was sort of overlooking the other thing that we'd lost that the poem is also trying to deal with. He also, you know, remarked that the poem made him look like less than an excellent fisherman. So that bothered him a little bit, too. But it's all true. He did not catch a fish that day.
I wonder if we could, if you would mind reading another poem about your father. This is Enlightenment. And your father, Canadian, I think it's such a fascinating, your father, a Canadian, as we've been talking about, you all standing in front of a portrait of Thomas Jefferson. Mm-hmm. Would you mind reading that?
Yes, sure. This is perhaps the hardest poem I ever had to write for my fourth collection. It's a poem that tries to examine the kind of deeply ingrained and often unexamined notions of racial difference that are manifest in the society at large, but even in the intimate relations within families, as with my beloved white father. Enlightenment. In the portrait of Jefferson that hangs at Monticello, he is rendered two-toned, his forehead white with illumination, a lit bulb, the rest of his face in shadow, darkened as if the artist meant to contrast his bright knowledge, its dark subtext. By 1805, when Jefferson sat for the portrait, he was already linked to an affair with his slave. Against a backdrop blue and ethereal, a wash of paint that seems to hold him in relief, Jefferson gazes out across the centuries, his lips fixed as if he's just uttered some final word. The first time I saw the painting, I listened as my father explained the contradictions, how Jefferson hated slavery, though, out of necessity, my father said, had to own slaves, that his moral philosophy meant he could not have fathered those children, would have been impossible, my father said. For years, we debated the distance between word and deed. I'd follow my father from book to book, gathering citations, listen as he named, like a field guide to Virginia, each flower and tree and bird, as if to prove a man's pursuit of knowledge is greater than his shortcomings, the limits of his vision. I did not know then the subtext of our story, that my father could imagine Jefferson's words made flesh in my flesh, the improvement of the blacks in body and mind in the first instance of their mixture with the whites, or that my father could believe he'd made me better. When I think of this now, I see how the past holds us captive, its beautiful ruin etched on the mind's eye, my young father, a rough outline of the old man he's become, needing to show me the better measure of his heart, an equation writ large at Monticello. That was years ago. Now we take in how much has changed. Talk of Sally Hemings, someone asking, how white was she? Parsing the fractions as if to name what made her worthy of Jefferson's attentions, a near-white quadroon mistress, not a plain black slave. Imagine stepping back into the past, our guide tells us then, and I can't resist whispering to my father, this is where we split up. I'll head around to the back. When he laughs, I know he's grateful I've made a joke of it, this history that links us, white father, black daughter, even as it renders us other to each other.
That's Enlightenment by Natasha Trethewey, who's here with me. That's from Thrall, her most recently published work. She published that in 2012. I mean, as you listen to that, it's very clear to understand why that was such a difficult thing for you to write. And I read, do you write everything? You write out your poems by hand?
I do.
And then, so that's sort of you draft out by hand?
Yeah, I spend several drafts handwritten long before I ever go to the computer and begin to sort of move things around. It's a whole different drafting process when I move from handwriting to typing it out.
And may I ask how many handwriting drafts did Enlightenment take?
Oh my goodness. Enlightenment took a lot of drafts. I don't know exactly how many handwritten drafts, but after I typed it in the first time, then I'll print out the drafts as I work on them, and I handwrite on them the changes and the scratching out and all that. So, you know, I have a stack probably at least that thick, an inch thick.
And then you save all of them, right?
Yeah,
do you save
all of them.
Good. Mm-hmm. Okay. Wow. You know, there's so much in that, in Enlightenment. There's so much to discuss. But I wonder if I can just ask you about the South and our understanding of the South, mm-hmm. Outside of the, you know, outside of not, and I don't even mean Southern history, I even mean today.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if you think we have at all done an adequate job in this country of sort of understanding each other's regional pasts and histories.
Well, one of the things it seems to me, being a native Southerner and traveling outside of the out of the South, is the ways in which the stereotypes about the South seem to hang on. There are so many ways that any Southerner, black or white, is bound to get defensive about the South because we're often, you know, portrayed as, you know, backwards and slow. And I mean, you know, the list of stereotypes go on. I'm sure your audience knows more than I even know, coming from the place. But I think what gets missed is the complexity of a place like the South, and particularly my home state, Mississippi. You know, my relationship with the South is the I think the only kind one can really have if you're a thoughtful person, and that is a love-hate relationship. There's plenty to hate about my South, but it's also my native land, and so I love it. Loving it means trying to make it better, and of course that is the most patriotic of acts, trying to make better the thing that you love.
Would you say that's probably true of, I would think, and I agree with you about the South. You know, I was telling you before we went on air, I didn't realize when you grew up in Florida, when you grew up in South Florida, you don't realize how Southern you are until you leave.
Mm-hmm.
And then I sort of realized the parts of my upbringing and my identity that were very Southern, mm-hmm. when I moved here to the Midwest. But do you think that probably most Americans have a sense of if they are thoughtful about this country, have sort of a love-hate relationship, no matter – I don't know if you feel like in the South it, you're making a face. You don't think that they do.
Well, that's why I said, you know, the thing I said before about the most patriotic of acts is to, you know, have that kind of love-hate relationship and to try to make a place better. There are plenty of people, I think, who sadly think any criticism of the South or the United States is unpatriotic. And it seems to me that those are the people that unquestionably love or are patriotic about the nation without also being able to talk about its flaws and all the things we need to fix.
Well, it's fascinating you say this. I was just watching a news report last week about Confederate monuments mm-hmm. and sort of the movement. And this has been a big issue in New Orleans mm-hmm. With the mayor wanting to remove monuments. And it sounds exactly like what you're saying. People who say we don't want to remove these monuments because, well, they're just part of our history. And we need to, you know, we need to have – it's okay to have a monument to Jefferson Davis because this is part of our history. And it doesn't mean, you know.
Well, I think the danger of removing monuments is not telling the full version of the story. We need to contextualize those monuments. You know, if you need to move them from a certain place, okay, put them over here, but put them with plaques that tell exactly why they were erected and what they mean. You know, monuments are doing different kinds of work. There are some monuments that were erected just say in the 19th century or at a different moment when the thinking in the nation was one way. Then there are monuments that were erected specifically as a response to the civil rights movement or, you know, the attempt to get equal rights for all of American citizens. Those are monuments that are meant to be in direct response, such as the Confederate flag in the state of Georgia. That's a flag that does not go back to the end of the Civil War, the one that we had that was so contested. It was one that was erected in direct response to Brown v. Board of Education. It was a message to African Americans.
There's so much of your work we haven't talked about. I'm thinking of Hurricane Katrina and all of that. As we're just about out of time, I did want to ask you, though, about what do you – I wonder if you have a – do you have a hope of what you think people will take away from your poetry, from your writing, particularly if they're American?
My goal is always to tell a fuller version of our story as Americans, not to erase one history in favor of another – not to look at them as two trains running on separate tracks, but to see how intertwined our stories are and how, in knowing our stories, we can continue the work to be the best nation that we can be, moving toward fulfilling the tenets of our Constitution.
I can't help but think as you say this of how much we've talked about in the past 9 months, in the past year, how divided we are as a country, how we don't how many parts of the country, whether it's rural or urban or southern or not, we don't understand each other. Do you think it's because we're not taking the time to try to understand that context, to hear these stories? Do you think it's a deeper problem?
I think it is hard to hear each other. It's hard because so much of our day-to-day language is the language of sound bites, cliches, the rise of uncivil discourse. And this is when I, you know, have to turn back to poetry again and again, because poetry does ask for us to slow down a little bit. It also, it's the one way we have of reaching not only the intellect but also the heart. It asks us to be more thoughtful, more empathetic. It asks us to see the world through a lens, an intimate lens, of someone else, their voice speaking to us across the distances. That's a way that I think we hear each other. And I can say it even now that, you know, some of the things that I say may sound incendiary to someone, but it's very different if you hear it in a poem, because that is, you know, the intimate nature of the soul trying to communicate with someone else's soul.
It's really another language.
It is another language, but it's one that I think can save us.
Thank you so much for taking the time to join us, to talk to us about your poetry, to read some of it. Natasha Trethewey, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
That does it for this special encore edition of The 21st. That's all the time we have for today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. If you have Alexa, we're easy to find. Tell Alexa, ask NPR One to play The 21st. All of those links, directions for Alexa, every other way to contact us. If you want to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, follow us on social media, it's all at our website, 21stshow.org. That's 21stshow.org. Follow us on Twitter. Search for 21stshow. That's our handle. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. When we're not on the air, you can follow us for the latest in Illinois news. If you search for us on Facebook, search for The 21st to like us. You can also comment on what we're working on, or you can post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. We're produced by Christine Herman, Alan Montesilio, and Sean Newman. Megan Jones is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Thanks to Joe Yoon and Nick Vance from the University of Illinois' Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help. And special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boudou. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.